joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you are the generous sort, you can be like Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John, who all support the podcast on Patreon. Through Patreon, you're able to support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store if you feel inclined. So check it out. Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Cook. Steve is a professor of fish ecology and conservation physiology at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. He has diverse interests, but is particularly active in research related to recreational fisheries, science, and management. Cook is an avid angler with particular fondness for largemouth bass deep in the slop. Welcome to the podcast, Steve.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Almost every time I see your name on a paper, I think something along the lines of, what a cool paper or project. How do you get the ideas for the projects or papers? Are they your brain children, or you mentioned in the bio that it's related to recreational fisheries. Are they kind of inspired by anglers?
Yeah, a little bit of both. So I won't pretend to be the one comes up with all the ideas. They're usually co-opted in some way or inspired by someone or something else, some observations along the way. So I certainly spend lots of time, both because I like fishing and because I study the topic, interacting with anglers. A year ago, that was at club meetings, but these days that's more online, via social media, reading websites and blogs and so on, trying to keep up essentially with what's happening. I also subscribe to a bunch of fishing magazines, and that certainly is helpful for trying to, you know, keep my eye or sort of have a pulse on what's going on in the community and what anglers are talking about. But I also have pretty diverse research interests. So today we're talking about recreational fishery science, in our lab, we also do work in the sort of integrated biology sphere. And so if we're doing work on the thermal biology of fish, we're oftentimes reading studies on herps. There's a lot of great behavioral endocrinology work that's done on birds, and all of that is useful. So we spend a lot of time sort of reading and thinking across boundaries. So thinking about what's happening in other disciplines and how that might be relevant to recreational fishery science or fishery science in general. So definitely don't have an issue with always keeping my ears and eyes open for those ideas. And oftentimes, again, partly for work and partly for pleasure, I tend to think about things through that rec fishing lens.
What's the most harebrained inspiration you received from anglers, or maybe an angling forum or website or magazine?
Probably started about 10 years ago. I started to see examples of where folks were pouring carbonated beverages over the gills of fish or down the esophagus of fish with the idea that it would stop bleeding. So if a fish is deeply hooked, an angler has their pop nearby and they just, or their cola, they just pour it on and the bleeding magically stops. And this is something that, initially, I remember some talks back in the day where I kind of made fun of that, and just sort of used that as an example of how, there's definitely some silly things that anglers do, but it didn't go away. It was something that started to appear more and more. It was covered in fishing magazines. Some people swore by it. Others argued that it was bad for the fish. And at some point, I guess it was about 2 years ago, I said, okay, I've had enough of this. My colleagues are going to think I'm a fool, but let's go down this path. Let's actually do some science. The number of hits we were seeing on these news articles, or Facebook posts sometimes were over 100,000. So there were lots of people reading about this. There were lots of people doing it. And so it was time to bring science to the table. So, we got our hands on, went to Walmart and got our hands on a couple cases of Mountain Dew and Coke. And then we also bought ourselves one of those carbonated beverage machines because we wanted to carbonate lake water. That would be a really good control to use. There are a bunch of controls we used, including lake water, carbonated lake water, and of course doing nothing. And so we injured fish. We used northern pike because they were plentiful. And a lot of people use this for muskie. That's one of the big groups that that think this is a good idea. So we did the work, and at the end of the day, we found that there was no benefit from using pop or cola to stop bleeding. There was no evidence that it stopped bleeding. But what was cool is we also think we know why it tricks people, why it gives the impression that it actually stops bleeding. And so when you pour when you air expose fish, they immediately go into something called a bradycardia, which is a fancy word for basically the heart slows down. And if you pour a carbonated beverage, an acidic beverage, over the gills, that also will invoke a rather severe bradycardia. So in other words, the fish essentially hold their breath. That's a bit of a simplification, but their heart stops. If we were actually measuring heart rate in real time, it would cease. And it usually stops for, 15, 20, 30 seconds. And then all of a sudden, there'll be one beat. And then a couple seconds later, there'll be another beat. And then half a second later, another beat. And it quickly ramps up. But it went through this period of 25, 30 seconds or so where there was no heartbeat. And if you think of what the heart does, it is squeezing and pushing blood throughout the system. And so every time it does, there's a pulse of pressure that would push blood out through an injury. And so as an angler, you do that. You put the fish back in the water because they've clearly stopped breathing. That's what it appears to have happened. And then the fish swims away only to bleed out potentially minutes later, or maybe it recovers. We didn't find that Coke killed the fish, but it's also not the best thing to do. So if you've got some pop on board the boat and you've got a fish that's bleeding and you're thirsty, I would drink the pop. I would not waste it on the fish. That's the silliest thing we've done.
We could probably do an entire podcast series on all the different projects that you've had your name attached to, but I thought today we'd talk specifically about some more emerging issues, and issues might not be the correct word there, but issues in recreational fisheries management. I guess these aren't necessarily the biggest issues, but some that are fun to discuss. Yeah. Not long ago, some co-authors and yourself released a paper titled Technological Innovations in Recreational Fishing Sector, Implications for Fisheries Management and Policy. So let's start there since it's the most recent. It is not as if we suddenly had a boom in fishing technologies. So what gave you and the co-authors the idea for this paper?
This idea grew out of sort of the techno-science movement. I've been paying attention to this in that I do a lot of fish tracking work. So we put electronic tags in and on fish and we track them around, and we do so to learn about the, how they use different habitats and identify movement corridors and so on. And there was starting to be some interesting examples of how that technology was being misused or abused. So examples of where members of the public would get their hands on tracking gear and go out and find animals and try and exploit them. And also started to see some other things pop up on social media as well, where anglers were sharing sites and, doing so in ways that they attempted to hide where they were fishing. And there were all sorts of efforts to try and figure out where they actually were, using, everything from, image recognition software to, freedom of information requests to people that had been fishing in government parks. And so we started thinking about how does technology play out in the recreational fishing sector? There have been a bunch of pretty big innovations in fish finders. And, for a long time, a fish finder really meant depth finder, right? It would show you how deep it was. And maybe, there's a little bit of magic and maybe those were fish you were seeing. But the technology has improved to the point where you can fish and actually watch a fish essentially turn its body and strike your lure. You can identify fish at depth. So this is, really, really high quality imagery. And that's come out in the last few years, and that's been a game changer. So started to think about that. But there are lots of other things too, even, changes in hook technology, changes in the materials used to make hooks, changes in fishing reel technology where there, you know, there's small computers in some of my reels now. So when I cast, you know, even if I'm not paying attention, the likelihood of getting a bird's nest is pretty much nil. So, and in particular, the big one is the use of drones and ROVs. So we're seeing examples where people are able to access water that they couldn't access before. So somebody could be fishing from shore, and we see this a lot in surf fisheries in the marine realm. So somebody's sitting at shore, they've got a big rod, and instead of casting it out, they have their drone, aerial drone, carry it, the lure out, and deliver it into areas that they previously weren't able to cast to. So we're starting to access new fish. And then some people even fish with that technology. So there's images or videos on YouTube of people actually catching and bringing those fish back to shore using drones. And so it brings up all sorts of questions. And some of these things are so silly and ludicrous that, you know, you can't imagine them, but anglers have, and they're doing them. And so the purpose of this paper was to really just get fisheries managers thinking proactively about all the changes that have occurred and things that are coming down the pipeline. And what we argue is that it's better to be prepared and think ahead instead of having to sort of, you know, after the fact, try and quickly throw in some rules or regulations to stop something that's already been embraced by the community.
I remember growing up as a teenager and into my early college years, I was a big bass fisherman, and I would get Bassmaster magazine all the time. And I remember seeing these ads of these scientific lures with red LEDs that blinked in the lures to imitate bleeding. And I just thought that was the coolest thing. I needed to get one, but they're like $30 a piece or something. And they were probably just gimmicky things, but a lot of these advances, you can't see my air quotes, are kind of gimmicky, but some of them are also make the angler more efficient. And a lot of the more high-end stuff, like the cameras and boat technology and all that, it's not gimmicky at all, but it actually does improve the angling efficiency. And you did a pretty good job in your last answer of breaking down each of the 10 different sections in the paper, and they all have their unique problems, but which is the most concerning to you, or what was the most concerning to your co-authors?
I think the drones are probably right up there. And this is a discussion that's actually being had more broadly in natural resource management. You can imagine if this was the wildlife podcast, we might be talking about drones and hunting. And that might sound silly, but there's already rules that have had to be created to prevent this from happening. So hunters have been using drones, actually mounting guns on drones and using them. I believe it was Texas has had to institute regs along that line, those lines. And I think a number of jurisdictions have now too, which again, 10 years ago, you would have thought of that as being a military application. But people are now experimenting, and you know the technology is only getting better and better, able to carry heavier payloads and more easier flight control. So these are the kinds of things that we need to be thinking about proactively. And I think that at some point there's discussions that could be had around what is sort of fair or sporting. Those are philosophical, and that's not a space that I like to operate in too much. But it's and those are conversations for society as a whole to have. Maybe we are comfortable with the idea that fishing can be done by drones, that you don't even need a fishing rod. But is that something we all buy into? What would licensing look like? What are the safety issues? And so on. So the drones, certainly a big one. Some of the gimmicks that you mentioned, yeah, all the fancy lures and so on, those ones are indeed silly. They're what I call wallet thinners. They're certainly fun to think about, and I'm sure they lure in lots of anglers that want to buy them. And there's some really interesting examples, actually, of fishery scientists in the past putting their name on various various lures. And there's a classic example of some researchers who basically tried to work out how pH and water temperature and turbidity and a few other things influenced fish vision. And then based on that, you would select certain colors to use with fishing. At the end of the day, it was abandoned. A lot of people say, well, you know, how do we know it doesn't work? And I think the answer is if it worked, they'd still be selling a whole pile of them. And the answer is they're not. So I think it's one of those things where, you know, it's a quick, you know, get rich scheme. You know, somebody's having a little bit of fun with it. You know, I always sort of muse, you know, if I wanted to to fleece fellow anglers, you know, what fancy words would I use to describe the lure that I would invent?
We've mentioned, both of us have, that some of these are kind of gimmicky, but a lot of the technology does make the angler more efficient, or allows the angler to target larger species and not just pick their way through whatever bites. But it doesn't always guarantee success. But if they are successful, how could increased efficiency or targeting those larger fish and avoiding the smaller fish impact recreational fisheries?
Oh, I totally agree with you. And I have to always remind my kids that it's called fishing and not catching. And I also do a presentation fairly often to fishing clubs and groups titled "The Science of Catching and Releasing Fish." And I spend 90% on the releasing part and only about 10 on the catching part, because at the end of the day, I've looked at all the science. Rob Lennox, who used to be in my lab, did a big lit review on what affects fish catchability. And at the end of the day, there's no magic bullets. Basically, you know, you need to have a bait in the vicinity of a fish when it is in a state that it might actually bite or strike said bait. So, which, you know, that's hardly rocket science. So there is no magic recipe or scientific trick to catching fish other than, you know, spending time on the water. I think just good old natural history observations, whether made by a scientist or whether made by an angler, I think that's how you get better. But just when you think you've patterned fish, the pattern changes and they trick us. So that's what makes fishing fascinating, but I went on a bit of a tangent there. In terms of concerns, so certainly we're really concerned about the selective effects of fishing. So if fishing gear inadvertently selects for certain phenotypes, for example, the more aggressive animals or the fast growing animals, and if we think about climate change or other threats that are coming at us, we want to have the greatest diversity of genetic material within a population, excuse me, that's able to respond to and be resilient in the face of whatever comes next, so that there is potential for adaptation. And so certainly anything that is selective, anything that we don't do a good job of controlling effort in the recreational fisheries realm, we tend to control harvest. So we say, hey, you know, you're not allowed to catch fish that are of, you know, or take harvest fish that are of a particular size or a particular species at a given time. But effort is much harder to control. And in many ways, things like, you know, places where anglers can't normally get and fish that we normally can't access, that's sort of like a protected area, right? It almost functions as, you know, a bit of a safety net to know that there's always a proportion of the population that we aren't going to figure out. And the reality is, with advanced imaging, with drone technology, with sharing of knowledge using social media and so on, it's really easy for people to become empowered and have the ability to reach areas, to reach fish that were previously probably out of reach of anglers. And so that part's a little bit scary, the idea that there are reservoirs of fish that have been protected based on the spaces they occupy and how cryptic they are. And now we're just pretty darn good at finding them. And when we're good at finding them, we're good at catching them, and we're good at catching them. Even if we put them all back, there's going to be some fishing related mortality, and some of those fish will likely get harvested too. So yeah, it's certainly on the effort side, the increased efficiency, and the more fish we catch, there's greater likelihood that we will see higher levels of absolute fishing mortality, even if that's just release mortality.
many states already limit the number or size of hooks that an angler can use. So there is some existing regulations on fishing technology, although it's kind of limited. But where do you think that path begins to get a little slippery with the banning or regulation of certain technologies, especially like the boat electronics or underwater cameras or drones?
Whenever we're coming up with policy and regulations, as scientists, we always like to think that things are science-based or evidence-based, but some decisions also spill into the social realm. And, you know, at the end of the day, decision-making is oftentimes very much a political process. And so there are discussions that need to be had, and it will be prominent angling groups that represent vast swaths of the recreational fishing sector that will be quite vocal about this, and I think helping to steer the conversation. We've seen this a little bit in the past, actually. There was some efforts. It started in Canada, actually. This is about a decade and a half ago, to ban the use of lead fishing sinkers. And there's a pretty strong opposition to it. Some of it was based on the science, but a lot of it was sort of based around this idea that this should be bottom up. You know, let the fishing companies sort this out, let the industry sort this out, and we'll make it happen. I would argue that we're 10 or 12 years down the road, and aside from tungsten, which is a lovely product and expensive product to use for fishing, if I go to the local tackle shop, most of what I'm going to see on the shelf is still lead. So I think that's an example where the industry essentially promised to take action, and we haven't seen it. And so that does scare me a little bit that, you know, the industry always sort of goes after this self-policing mode, yet that doesn't necessarily result in changes that have the potential to benefit fish and aquatic ecosystems. So yeah, they're tough conversations. As I mentioned, there's a lot of philosophical debates to be had. Certainly anything that has the potential to do damage to fish or injure fish, those are things that I think we want to think about carefully. So if there are certain lure types or bait types or hook types that are more injurious to fish, and with simple changes that can be addressed, I think that's low-hanging fruit. I think there's also a lot of untested things. There's a lot of products out there that claim to, say if you're holding fish in a live well, that they're magical. They'll do everything. You know, they'll get rid of the chlorine. They'll stop the bleeding. They'll help the fish. You know, they'll expedite recovery from stress and so on. But these, for the most part, are untested claims. And if it was so magical, we would see the same products being used in fish hatcheries or in fisheries research, and we're not. So, you know, what are the consequences of those substances on fish? And what are the consequences on those substances on humans that consume the fish that those have been in? So these are questions. I don't know if things are safe or not. Just a bunch of claims on unregulated products doesn't make me feel safe as a consumer or make me think that that's necessarily a good idea for fish. So that's one example, but there are many others. So yeah. And that's, again, the reason why we really wanted to wave the flag with this paper. We're hoping this is the kind of paper that will stimulate discussions that around North America and beyond, that, you know, fisheries chiefs will be sitting down with their staff in the, you know, the fisheries branch saying, hey, we haven't been thinking about this. Which of these issues are relevant to us? Which are the ones that concern us? Which are the ones that are important potentially to our various stakeholders and resource users? Where do we want to have a conversation, or where do we want to actually do something, implement a regulation or a policy change, or engage in education, which is oftentimes the best approach.
And in other cases, the technology might not be new, but its use in a new locale might be new, or how the technology might be being used is new. And such is the case with microfishing. In the year 2020, you authored a paper highlighting microfishing as an emerging form of angling. So what exactly is microfishing?
Yeah, microfishing is small. So it involves purchasing hooks that are so tiny that unless you have a superhero eyesight, you need to use a magnifying glass to tie the hooks on, or even to thread the line through the eye of the hook. 2-pound test is about as thick as one can use if you actually want to be able to get the line through the eye of the hook. These hooks are, I don't know how to describe them other than to say that they are ridiculously small. They would be dwarfed by a Tic Tac for context. They are about the size of the tip of a matchstick. And they are used to catch tiny, tiny fish. So there's a segment, a unique segment of the angling population that is more interested in catching a diversity of fish than catching the biggest fish or just catching the obvious game fish. So these are folks not unlike bird watchers who might go out and, you know, they're trying to add another species to their list of the number of species that they've seen. And they might keep track on an annual basis and also on a lifetime basis. And that's kind of the same thing with microfish. And it tends to be people that really admire fish, that want to get up close and personal with them in their natural environment. A lot of microfishing is done via mask and snorkel. And they actually are individually targeting the fish that they want to catch. So you can imagine somebody snorkeling in a crystal clear stream in Tennessee, you know, that has 30 species of darter in it that are all colorful as heck, and trying to catch one of each and get a photograph of each of those fish. Most of the microfishers are quite responsible. They oftentimes carry these sort of glass or clear plastic chambers that they fill with water and put the fish in to try and get really, really great photos of these animals. And in most cases, they're put back. But there's also been some benefits for science. It's potentially a relatively benign approach for catching animals, maybe to bring in to a captive breeding program if it's a highly endangered species. And there's some fish that are just hard to catch in other ways. And so there are a number of folks who are really good at microfishing who have helped scientists catch animals for various experiments. So yeah, so that's what microfishing is all about.
And you mentioned a couple times that they target fairly small fish. I guess, what are some examples of some type of fish that they are typically targeting?
Yeah, so darters certainly are in the mix. And so I gave that example of Tennessee. Tiny, tiny cyprinids. Oftentimes things that are rare, and things that are rare oftentimes are threatened or imperiled in some way. So a good example would be something like the red-side dace in Ontario. So they aren't doing so well. Populations are doing relatively poorly, but they're absolutely gorgeous fish. And they're tiny, tiny. They're, 2.5 inches long, might be a giant. And so that's an example of the kind of fish that that folks go after. And I sort of alluded to the idea that it's probably pretty benign. And if we're talking about threatened or endangered fish, there's discussions to be had. Is it better to electrofish them? Is it better to catch them in a pot trap? Is it better to catch them on a tiny, tiny hook? The answer is, I'm pretty sure we don't know. At least we don't know how microfishing measures up. And so I think that was one of the other purposes of that paper. Again, we're kind of, waving the flag saying, hey, fisheries managers, is this something you've thought about? And also alerting the recreational fisheries science community that there's probably some good research questions there. So I would say about a third of that paper is a list of all the research questions that we think are worthwhile tackling. Obviously, we don't need to investigate this for every fish and every location, but there's certainly some species that are targeted more than others and some species that are more imperiled than others. So it's probably worth having a look and seeing if we can generate some science-based best practices for microfishing. My guess is that what we tell anglers about how to handle a muskie, a trophy muskie, might be a little bit different than the guidance we would want to give somebody that's microfishing. So that's one of the things that we've called for. I did During the past summer, with the help of my three children, we did our first microfishing study. And just last week, I handed off the data set to a new grad student who's just sort of settling into life in the lab and was looking for something to do. And so Declan's going to do what he can to get that written up as a little note. We used a juvenile bluegill as a model, not a fish that's in any way endangered or rare, but it allowed us to get really big sample sizes and compare a couple different hook sizes.
Near the end of the microfishing paper, you note that the concept of microfishing is one that requires a major rethink of what defines a game fish. In your opinion, what should be the definition of game fish, or should we just quit labeling fish as sport and non-sport?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Yeah, we wrote that, but I can't say I thought that through. I think we have previously written a paper on what defines a game fish. And that was essentially, to do that, what we did is looked at what all the IGFA fish that are considered game fish, so ones that are on their list. And then we contrasted that with a random set of others. And on average, game fish are bigger. On average, they tend to be more predatory, you know, which isn't surprising. You know, they're more likely to, you know, to hit a lure if you're a, you know, a predator and so on. But yeah, microfishing, you know, some of these fish are eating in, you know, at maybe inverts. Some of them might be eating literally zooplankton that is being mimicked by lures. Or by baits that are being used by microfishers. So yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the terminology game fish. And I'm even less of a fan of the word non-game fish or coarse fish, because I think it sort of gives an odium associated with them. You know, fish are cool and fish are fish, and some are targeted by anglers and some by indigenous fishers and some by commercial fishers and others are not. And at the end of the day, even the fish that no one targets, their fish food for something else. And they play important roles in structuring our ecosystems, so our aquatic ecosystems. So yeah, I'm not a big one for labels. So I think I'd rather describe the sectors, because we've got some pretty good definitions for what is recreational fishing versus subsistence and so on, as opposed to trying to label fish themselves.
You mentioned in one of your earlier answers that cyprinids are typically targeted in microfishing, but another emerging angling method targets another cyprinid not traditionally labeled as a sport fish in North America. And I don't have any data to back this up, but it certainly seems as if European-style carp angling is catching on in North America. Have you observed the same thing in your neck of the woods?
Yep. If you want to buy specialized carp fishing gear, you can do it at most tackle shops now. And in fact, they have specialist carp fishing stores. I know here in Ontario and across the way in New York State. So that's definitely a thing. And in fact, a bunch of years ago, one of my good friends, Robert Arlinghouse, he had a student, Tobias Rapp, and Tobias was super into carp fishing and he wanted to do his master's thesis on carp. And in Germany, there's a whole bunch of really nutty carp anglers that are super specialized, really into it. But they don't actually have a lot of carp in Germany. And so there might be, you know, there's a lake, you know, it might be an urban lake and, you know, there might be 10 or 15 people set up fishing it. But there's only one carp. There's one fish everybody's after. And so if one person hooks up and lands that fish, everybody else just packs up and goes home. Whereas some of the lakes in and around where I live, first of all, there's not much competition for them and you can catch them hand over fist. So Toby spent some time in Ottawa and we did a bunch of catch and release studies on carp with the idea that in Germany, they care about this quite a bit. Not surprisingly, this isn't going to be a shocker. Carp are pretty much bulletproof. A silly thing that carp anglers do, they care a lot about the photograph, especially when it's one of those trophy fish. So, and oftentimes they catch the carp in the night. And of course you can't get a good photo at night. So they throw the fish in a keep sack, leave it in the keep sack till morning, till there's good light. But now you've got a carp that's recovered, okay? The fight, you know, you might have caught it 6 or 8 hours ago. And so it's all of a sudden really vigorous. And carp are big, they're hard to handle. And, you know, there's no way that you can, you know, nicely wrestle a carp and grab a good photo. So then they take the carp sack and hang it in a tree. And they leave it in a tree typically for 8 or 9 or 10 minutes till the fish have calmed down. So sort of forced air exposure. Then they grab their photo, then they let it go. And so there are a lot of questions from a welfare perspective. And again, I want to be clear, we're not worried about the state of, introduced carp populations here in North America. And in fact, we do a lot to try and control them. But in that case, that was a fish that, basically you gave them air exposure, they just turned around and laughed at you when they swam away. So needless to say, there's at least from a survival perspective, carp do well. Sure, you can talk about welfare issues, but at least for carp, those issues probably aren't going to resonate super, super well, given that so much of our efforts here focus on eradicating carp.
And you mentioned that there's so many fewer carp over in Europe compared to North America. Is there anything different about common carp here in North America that we have so many of them compared to Europe, or is it just that they actually enjoy fishing for them and they've caught them?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly in the past, there would be some harvest, and there's certainly, particularly in Eastern Europe, there's a lot of folks that culturally eat carp. There's a lot of smoked carp. And so I think there's certainly been some pressure there. And interestingly, actually, we're starting to see, obviously Canada and the US, incredible and amazing ethnic diversity. And we're starting to see different anglers based on their ethnicity targeting different fish. And so there's absolutely nothing wrong with carp, but they've got among sort of the old school traditional North American angler, a lot of people would sort of turn their nose up at them. But carp have a lot of good meat, and folks that know how to prepare them know how to prepare them well. So there's actually some opportunities there to help support nutritional security and to spread around different fishing effort. I think climate probably plays into it as well, and general productivity of the systems here in Eastern Ontario, where I am, and in the St. Lawrence. It would appear to be prime carp growing habitat. They grow fast, they grow big, lots of good habitat, and winter doesn't seem to be too problematic for them. Yes, we have real winters here, but we also have real summers, so plenty of time for them to grow.
Do you think that there is a place for this style of fishing in North America, or is there just too large of a stigma on the word carp?
They're fun to catch. So I do think there's a space for them, and I think it benefits all of us if we can spread the pressure out across a greater number of species. Not everyone needs to fish for bass, muskie, walleye, Atlantic salmon, steelhead. There's nothing wrong with having people target carp or white sucker or some of the other lesser known species. It spreads out effort, and there's certainly some sustainable fisheries opportunities there. There's room for harvest.
In Kansas, we have a small group of carp anglers on that have their own Facebook group and everything, and they've begun to ask our agency when we're going to be managing for trophy carp fisheries in our state, and they're quick to point out other states have adopted some regulations. So there are some efforts out there to create these opportunities for anglers, and it's kind of an interesting predicament on whether to remove them or to create these fisheries for recreational use. And you could probably do both to grow these trophy carp like they need. I think that you'd need to thin out some of these carp and to create room to grow these trophy fish that they're after. So it's an interesting brainstorming idea on how to please these anglers.
Yeah, and there's more and more of these highly specialized anglers. These are not average Jane and Joe that fish a couple times a year. These are people that really specialize on a single species or a single mode of fishing. And I think we first saw that in North America with muskie, where we had specialized muskellunge anglers. And, most muskellunge anglers fish for muskie. That's what they do. They might chase walleye or bass now and again, but it's really all about the muskie. And the same thing with carp. Carp are another example of one of those highly specialized fisheries, bonefish, and permit, yet another. So I think we're going to see more and more of that as there's gear, further gear specializations, and as anglers increasingly are able to learn about what's happening in other places. We've now got global trade, so we can get our hands on the latest fishing gear and innovations from Japan or the UK or Australia. And that really opens doors for individuals to specialize here. And as they specialize and organize, that's when you start to see them reaching out, such as the group of carp anglers that you talked about in Kansas. And I expect that we'll see more and more of that. And, you know, that does create some challenges for the fisheries managers. It's way easier, I would think, to just, you know, if everybody does the same thing, it's way easier to try and make everybody happy. The reality is that anglers are very heterogeneous. And the more we specialize, that means there's more need to try and do things to satisfy different needs and address different sustainability issues associated with those different fisheries.
We've highlighted only a few projects from the amazing catalog of work you've completed so far. And I'll ask sort of a dream project question here in a bit, but first, is there a project that you would like to do that perhaps you just haven't figured out how to do it? Maybe a question that you haven't quite figured out how to answer yet?
Yeah, I'd really like to wrap my head around on the wreck fish side of things. You know, what are the consequences of having recreational fishing interactions with fish in the time leading up to reproduction? You know, trying to get at those fitness impacts. So do we need to worry about catching fish before they spawn? In the laboratory, we know from work in aquaculture that if you stress fish before they spawn, you will get, you know, reductions in gamete quality and quantity. But Mother Nature is a little bit different, and oftentimes we see compensation in nature. I think that's something that I would love to sort out. We've tried in a couple different ways, but we're always just kind of, you know, clawing around the edges. There's been, you know, I think there's some genetic techniques now that we can use, and there's been some good work done in both Quebec and in Idaho using those genetic approaches to try and look at fitness impacts. So I think that's certainly one of them. And then also trying to put fisheries interactions into a longer term context. So, you know, if you're a steelhead and you get caught once, that's one thing. If you're a steelhead and you get caught three times in a season, you know, what does that mean? What happens when you're also caught in the estuary and then also caught on the way back in twice more, year over year? So how do these cumulative fisheries interactions add up? Same thing goes for trophy bass that might be in, you know, over the course of their lives, they might be, you know, hoisted up in a number of different fishing tournaments. What are the consequences of those sort of repeated interactions on lifetime fitness? Very difficult questions to get at. What is the lifetime fitness of a bass? And, you know, do those fisheries interactions affect it? Not easy to do. And that's something that we'll continue to scratch our heads about and try and figure out how to tackle.
Well, Steve, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we're down to the final five questions. And this is the group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Got to be largemouth bass. Just as I said in the intro, and it's not just largemouth bass, it's largemouth bass in the slop, the thickest of the slop.
And we've highlighted a bunch of really exciting projects that you've been a part of, but what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
You know, as an educator, certainly there's the training aspect. That's always important. But I've increasingly pivoted to really try and do science that has impact, not just in the sphere of wreck fishing, but more broadly. And so I think the work that we've been doing to try and understand how decisions are made and try to break down that or bridge that gap between knowledge and action, or science and policy. And so we've been doing some social science work, trying to understand that interface, and also being very reflective, looking back at our failures, and our successes and trying to learn from that and use that to move forward. I'm all for fundamental research. I do fundamental research or discovery research or blue sky research, whatever you want to call it. But when I'm doing applied research that's being paid for by applied sources, I better be doing research that has impact, or why am I even bothering? And so that's kind of where my head's at these days. So really trying to increase the impact of the applied work that we do.
Certainly sounds like you're already in it, but what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
Yeah, definitely in the dream job. Love the institution, love the colleagues, love our team. And I love this part of the world. I won't lie. I wish that get to some warmer climes and more mountainous. I like the warmth, but I also like mountains and snow. I think I'm just keen to be able to, you know, get back to travel, maybe not quite so silly levels of travel as before. I definitely need some sun and beach and, you know, mangroves in my life. But I've been able to do that from here. I've got incredible freedom. And for that, I'm very fortunate. And, you know, there's lots of other things you can trade off, but freedom is really important to me.
And I asked earlier, what was one project that you just haven't been able to wrap your head around yet? But if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
I would like to focus on trying to figure out how to modernize fisheries management, not just recreational fisheries management, conservation more broadly, in a way that it was more real time. We've got incredible technologies now, everything from biotelemetry and biologging to, LIDAR and satellite imagery and cell phone data and eDNA, and it just kind of goes on and on and on. And we're pretty good at collecting data, so we can track fish and then kind of, you know, smack down a 1 terabyte file on a grad student's desk and say, enjoy. And then 3 years later, you know, they kind of tell you the answer. And that does not enable real-time fisheries management. And so I think there's ways to, with new data analytics, big data approaches, I think that the data science community has the potential to help us take these amazing technological advances that we have and build on the back end so that we move from data to decisions much more quickly. Potentially, you know, I'm talking on the order of hours or maybe a day or two. And I think that that could really change things. I think that could create opportunities for fisheries exploitation that we currently can't do. And I think it allows us to be more risk averse, close things when we get the hint that things are maybe a little bit off, maybe with the run timing of a fish coming back on migration or unexpected mortality or disease surveillance, all of these things. But it's the data side of things where we've got those challenges. So they can be solved. I'm just not the one to solve it, but I'll be a cheerleader and would love to help make that happen.
And finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Boy, well, I try and have fun with everything I do. And so I think it's also how I approach science. It's how I approach team building, how I approach problem solving. There's a lot of people I work with once, and there's a lot of people I work with over and over again. And it's a matter of finding people that are, you know, that sort of a similar mindset and like to have fun. And I like to mix fishing and work. And so I certainly like to spend time with folks on the water, but I also like to mix running and work. I love to go running with colleagues. I like to break bread with colleagues and talk fish, but it's always fun. And that's the core. Things that aren't fun, I try and to the extent possible, push them to the side. Yeah, I've always got some grading I have to do, and there's things we don't like with our job, but I even try and, you know, you try and find the brightness in all of that. Because life's too short, and my gosh, this year has been brutal. We've lost so many amazing fisheries professionals. It's been really a sad year, and To me, it just reinforces the importance of, you know, living life and live it big and getting lots of friend time, family time, you know, try and leave the world in a better place and help our fish out.
Steve, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and a small handful of all the different projects that you've been a part of. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
We've got a pretty up-to-date website. It's updated more or less weekly. It's www.fecpl.ca. My email is Stephen.Cooke at Carleton, spelled Carleton.ca. I'd love to hear from folks and really appreciate the opportunity to talk fish and share some of my thinking and ideas with the broader community. Thanks.
If you would like to get hold of me, you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at FisheriesPod, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly or one-time contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, stickers, or face masks available on Teespring. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 116th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, have fun with everything you do.